give our, the third of the set of mini courses on generalized collegiality. So there's a lecture here today, here tomorrow, and here on Thursday. And their title is Supersymmetric Backdrops for Generalized Collegiality Manifolds. Please go ahead.
Okay, thanks. So I'll be talking about work that other people did and work that I did in collaboration with Ian Lewis, Robert Minassian, Michela Petrini, Alessandro Tomasiello, and Dan Waldron. And although I have this laptop format, I will go slowly so that you can ask questions, take notes, and this has the format of a lecture more than standard and seminar. So we are interested in generalized, well, my part of the course is to talk about generalized complex geometry, and we use generalized complex geometry to understand compactifications of type 2 theory on six-dimensional manifold in the presence of fluxes. And compactifications here is in quotes because these are not, the six-dimensional manifolds are not necessarily compact, and that's one of the problems of this is hard to evade the no-go theorem, so maybe the six-dimensional manifolds are not compact, but we still talk about compactification. There is no better word to use it. So we want to, again, compactify type 2 supergravity on 10-dimensional manifolds, which are a product of a 4-dimensional manifold times a 6-dimensional manifold. If we require minimal supersymmetry to be preserved, what happens if there are no fluxes is that the six-dimensional manifold is Calabi-Yau. Now, when we turn on fluxes, this Calabi-Yau property is lost. If we want to preserve supersymmetry, the six-dimensional manifold cannot be Calabi-Yau anymore. At best, we have a conformal Calabi-Yau. This is the case when the fluxes are of a type, in type 2B, when the fluxes are imaginary self-dual, or we have D3 planes or O3 planes. But in general, this is not a conformal Calabi-Yau, it's no longer a Calabi-Yau. So in general, this is not Calabi-Yau anymore. Calabi-Yau is a space of SU3 holonomy. Now, when we turn on fluxes, what happens is that this SU3 holonomy goes into something called SU3 structure. So I'll talk about this, although maybe you've heard a little bit. I'll repeat it if you've heard it. I'll talk about what SU3 holonomy and SU3 structure means. In SU3 holonomy, there is a covariantly constant spinor. Again, we will see this in detail. When we have SU3 structure, there's still a covariantly constant spinor, but in a connection that is not the Levi-Civita connection, but is a connection with torsion. And this torsion is related to the flux in a non-trivial way. But this can be all summarized in one line, which is a Calabi-Yau goes to a twisted generalized Calabi-Yau. So here, by twisted generalized Calabi-Yau, well, first by generalized Calabi-Yau, you know we don't mean anything, just anything more general than a Calabi-Yau, but this has a precise meaning. And the meaning, the definition that we will use of generalized Calabi-Yau is Hitchin's definition, which is different than Gualtieri definition. I will tell you what the precise definition of generalized Calabi-Yau is. And twisting, we will see that the twisting that we get is not the standard twisting that maybe Gualtieri talked about. So this is an introduction, and I will talk about all this in detail. So the outline of the talk is the following. First, I will give you some introduction or motivation for to have flux compactifications or to introduce flux in the compactifications. Then we will talk about G structures, and in particular, SU3 structure is the one that we need in six dimensions. Then we will see how generalized Calabi-Yau emerged from n equal 1 supergravity vacuum. And then we will see, I will say a few words about n equals to 2 supergravity vacuum and how generalized Calabi-Yau or generalized structure arise. And then we will talk about the n equals to 2 effective actions and generalized structures. So the idea is we will do these two and maybe a little bit of the third point in the first lecture. The second lecture will be mainly this, and then the third lecture will be this. this will, depending on how we go on time, we can shift on things. So why do we want to turn on fluxes? So supersymmetric string and NPRE solution with fluxes play an important role in compactification for many reasons. The fluxes break part or all of the supersymmetry. While breaking supersymmetry, they fix some of the moduli of the compactification. In terms of ABS EFT, solution with fluxes are non-conformal theory duals. They also, the fluxes also induce, if the fluxes break supersymmetry and we have brains, the fluxes induce of supersymmetry breaking terms on the brains. And also the fluxes generate warp factors that will tell you what they are. And this was proposed to be a solution to the hierarchy problem. So there are many nice features about fluxes that we like. So we want to study compactification, supergravity compactification, where some fluxes are turned on. Now, we tell that when we turn on fluxes, the compactification manifolds are not Calabi-Yau anymore. And we need to characterize the allowed geometries. And then we need to try to extend. So this is something, all this hasn't been done, and part of this has been done and part has not. We need to extend the properties of conventional compactifications on Calabi-Yau to the new geometries, such as what are the moduli spaces, how the moduli get fixed, mirror symmetry, the brain, supersymmetry breaking. And generalized complex geometry provides a natural framework to study flux backgrounds. And we will always make use of the formalism of sheaf structures, which led to progress in understanding the properties of flux backgrounds. In particular, with sheaf structures, we have a classification of the allowed geometries. So again, we will discuss what these sheaf structures are. So first, we want to look at supersymmetric solution with fluxes. So if we look at the supersymmetric vacuum, we want this vacuum expectation value of a supercharge acting on a fermionic field to be zero. So this has to be zero for both for a fermionic and a bosonic field. If this is a bosonic field, then the result is a fermionic field, and it has zero vacuum expectation value if we don't want to break Lorentz invariant. So the only part that we have to take care of is this supercharge acting on a fermionic field. We have to impose that it has zero vacuum expectation value. And this is the supersymmetric transform. This is the supersymmetric transformation of the fermionic field. The fermionic fields in type 2 supergravities are the gravitino. There are two gravitinos and the two dilatinos. So we need to look at these equations, the supersymmetric transformation of the two gravitinos and the supersymmetric transformation of the two dilatinos. The supersymmetric transformation looks like this. So here, psi is psi 1, psi 2, and epsilon is also a column vector, epsilon 1, epsilon 2. And we have the NS flux and the Ramon-Ramon flux. The NS flux appears here with a sigma 3, so this means that epsilon 1 gets a plus 1 and epsilon 2 gets a minus 1 sign. And the Ramon-Ramon fluxes appear here with some Pn. So first this Fn, is Fn slash, it's the contraction of F in the number of gamma matrices. This is, here we use the democratic formulation in which we add all fluxes, so n is equal to 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9 for 2b. So we add the fluxes and their duals. And for 2a, n is equal to 0, 2, 4, 6, 8, and 10. And Pn is either sigma 1 or sigma 2, depending on n. So it alternates between sigma 1 and sigma 2. So what this does is switch epsilon 1 for epsilon 2 and then adds a minus sign somewhere for some of them. So this is a supersymmetric transformation that we will look most of the time, because here it's where where all the information of the geometry, or most of the information of the geometry, is encoded, because here we have the covariant derivative of the supersymmetric parameter. One thing is that these equations are linear in fields and derivatives, while the equations of motion, which are commutative of two supercharges, are quadratic. So we want to find supersymmetric solutions, but all the supersymmetric solutions are easier to find than the equations of motion. And it was shown that the solution to supersymmetric equations, plus the Bianchi identity and the equation of motion for the fluxes, so Bianchi identity and equation of motion, if these two are satisfied, this is the solution to the equations of motion. So we will look at supersymmetry, and then Bianchi identity, although in this, I won't talk about Bianchi identities in this case. Bianchi identities are the ones that give the no-go theorems. I won't talk about them. So without fluxes, this was supersymmetric solution without fluxes were worked out by Candela, Skorovic, Strominger, and Witten in 85. What we have is this is zero, so if we impose this equal to zero, we have that the spinner has to be covariantly constant. Now, if we are doing this product space, then so the matrix splits into something like this. So this is Minkowski metric, and this is the 16-dimensional metric. The spinner, we also split into a spinner in 4 dimensions, a spinner in 6. And then this condition means that the spinner in 4 dimensions is constant, and that the spinner in 6 dimensions is covariantly constant. So, of course, not any manifold has a covariantly constant spinner. This is a very strong requirement for the manifold. And it means that the manifold has reduced holonomy. So, I guess you all know what holonomy is, but just 1 minute of it won't hurt. So, for example, if we look at R2, we have a vector in R2. Now we want to parallel transport this vector along this line, and we get back this vector here. Now this is fine, there's no problem with it. If we parallel transport this vector around a closed loop, we will get back to the same vector. Now if we do R2 over set 6, so we identify points here under this reflection here, this point and this point get identified. So this now is a closed loop, and under set 6, this spinner here gets identified with this, this vector here gets identified with this vector. And this was the original vector that we departed, that we started from. So there's an angle between these two vectors, and this angle is a 60-degree angle. So that's the holonomy group of a manifold. It's the group of all transformations that a vector suffers when going around closed loops. So the holonomy of R2 over set 6 is set 6. So the holonomy of a 6-dimensional manifold, if the manifold is Riemannian, this is always contained in SO6. And we need for supersymmetry, well, the smaller the holonomy group, the more special the manifold is. And we need for supersymmetry that the holonomy is contained in SU3. And if we want minimal supersymmetry, the holonomy has to be SU3. Now, we want SU3 holonomy, a manifold of SU3 holonomy is a Calabi-Yau. And if we have SU3 holonomy, what we can do is split, break the SO6 representations into representations of SU3. For example, a vector is in the 6 of SO6, and it splits into 3 plus 3 bar. Thus, having SU3 holonomy, of course, it allows us to define complex coordinates, and in particular, this complex structure that allows us to define complex coordinates is integral. So here, there's no problem that these complex coordinates are defined globally. So this 6 can be broken into 3 plus 3 bar. A spinner in the 4 decomposes into a 3 plus 1. And this singlet here is our covariantly constant spinner. So this is a spinner that's a singlet under SU3 and it's covariantly constant. When we decompose a two-form in the 15, it's in the 15 of SO6, and decomposes as 8 plus 3 plus 3 plus 1, and you see that there's again a singlet. This singlet two-form is shaped, and probably was called omega or W by Valtieri, and I call it shape. A three-form is in the 10, and it's also decomposed under 6 plus 3 plus 1. There's also a singlet here in the three-form. This is omega, the holomorphic 3-0 form. And this, there are three singlets in the decomposition, a singlet for the spinner, there's a two-form singlet, and there's a three-form singlet. So there's an invariant spinner, an SU3 invariant spinner, an SU3 invariant form and an SU3 invariant free form. So we started with type 2 supersymmetry, so there were two 10-dimensional spinors, but we use this 6-dimensional SU3 invariant spinor to split the 10-dimensional spinor. And we see that there are two 4-dimensional conserved spinors, so we have when M10 is decomposed into M4 times the Calabi-Yau 6, we have n equals to 2 in 4 dimensions. So we have 8 supersymmetries preserved, n equals to 2 in 4 dimensions. So, I guess this is not new.
Ask a question.
Yeah.
In the supersymmetry equation, I mean, there are three terms.
Yes.
The third term, could you explain term by term what is. So, first of all, what happens with psi sub n?
What happens with?
Psi sub n, which is what is. You're applying delta epsilon to psi.
To psi, so this is the gravitino in the direction m, and the m. So the m is this m here, and this f is a contraction of f with all the gamma matrices. So this m here is an n that indexes the order, the degree of the flux, but it's not the tangent space index. So the index here is m. Sorry, that's a confusion because here we have np and here we have n. But this m is this m. Here, somewhere
is gamma supposed to be psi, or where is psi?
This is a supersymmetric transformation of psi is proportional to epsilon psi. So the supersymmetric transformation of psi, supersymmetric transformation of psi is equal to some bosonic, some bosons times epsilon.
And so you have further multiplication by the flux, but what is the meaning of this p sub n?
So P sub n is either sigma 1 or sigma 2. What this does is switch epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. So you have a supersymmetric transformation of psi 1 is proportional here in the part of Ramanujan flux is proportional to epsilon 2. And the supersymmetric transformation of psi 2 is proportional to epsilon 1. So this flips. This is sigma 1 of sigma 2, which is block diagonal. So this, not block diagonal, off diagonal. So this flips epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. So it's basically sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 1.
Oh, okay.
So it's alternating, yes. Okay, now we want to turn on flux. So first, when there is no flux, we do this. The 6-dimensional manifold is a Calabi-Yau. This is a manifold that has SU3 holonomy. With the SU3 holonomy, when there's SU3 holonomy, they're globally defined SU3 invariant tensors, which are the two forms and this holomorphic three form, or there is an SU3 invariant spinor. And actually, these two definitions are equivalent because the two form and the three form can be obtained as bilinears of the spinor with corresponding gamma matrices, and they obey this condition. Which will be important later. So we either say that there is a SU3 invariant two form and three form, or there is an SU3 invariant spinor. And this is the part that we need from supersymmetry equations. In supergravity, this is the part that is the SU3 invariant spinor. And this spinor, when there is a SU3 holonomy, this spinor is covariantly constant. So the covariant derivative of eta is equal to zero. If we insert this in here, we get that J and omega are closed. So the two form is closed, and omega is a closed three form. And again, decomposing, using eta to decompose the spinor, we preserve n equal to 2. So this is the old story when there is no flux. And now we want to turn on flux. So when we turn on flux, there is a back reaction on the 6-dimensional manifold, and there are many things that happen. The first, one thing is that we won't turn on any flux, but we'll turn on fluxes that preserve SO1,3. So for example, if we turn on F2 form flux, it will be only internal. three-form flux design. Four-form flux can have a component along spacetime and then an internal component, and the same for five, six. But we will use the duality of the fluxes, so Fn is related to Xn minus n, to express everything in terms of Fn in 2a, or in terms of f0, f2, f4, and f6, and in 2b in terms of f1, f3, and f5. And then, for example, we use this duality to write f minimum lambda rho, so an f4 that is along spacetime, in terms of an f6 that is only internal. So by using this, all fluxes are going to be internal. But we are allowing for the possibility of turning on fluxes that are always along spacetime. We're just dualizing to internal fluxes. So we said there's a back reaction, and there are many things that happen. The first is that the compactification, the manifold is not a product anymore, but it's a war product. So there is a war factor that appears. This is a function of the internal coordinates. So the four-dimensional metric is conform and Minkowski, but with this, well, it's not conform and Minkowski, because this function depends on the six-dimensional coordinates. So this is the war factor. Then also, in general, n equals to 2 is broken to n equals 1, and it can be broken up to n equals 0, but this is the situation that we are interested in. And this means that there is a relation between theta 1 and theta 2. We will parameterize this relation by this. So we will say that epsilon 1, so we will use eta, we will use always a six-dimensional invariant spinor. We will say that epsilon 1 is A times this, and epsilon 2 is B times this, where these A and B are constants, are complex numbers, which can be functions of internal space, if you want. And we will use this, we found it was convenient to use alpha and beta, which are these combinations of A and B. So basically, this alpha and beta tell you how you break from n equals to 2 to n equals 1. There are solutions that have alpha equal to 0 or beta equal 0. There are solutions that have alpha equal beta. There are solutions that have alpha equals I beta. These are different solutions that preserve different than equal 1 supersymmetry. And then finally, this six-dimensional manifold is no longer Calabi-Yau but acquires torsion. And the remnant...
A and B are real or not?
A and B are complex in general, yeah. So the six-dimensional manifold acquires torsion, so instead of SU3 holonomy, what we have is SU3 structure. I will tell you what it is. In the context of physics and in the context of supergravity compactification, this was first discussed by these people in 2002.
There actually be two different betas for epsilon 1 and epsilon 2.
Yeah, I will talk about that in the third lecture. So here we looked at the case where there's only one SU3 invariant spinor, but there could be two SU3 invariant spinors, and with that you can get n equals to 1, more general n equals 1 compactifications, or even n equals to 2 compactifications. So for today and tomorrow, there's only one eta here. For on Thursday, we will introduce two eta.
And can I generalize that eta to have an anti-Lucerne space?
Yes, you can. This we haven't done. And basically, what we have in 2a, this means that you have, if you turn on the front movement parameters or f4 along space time, you will have. Yes, this can. It's not very hard to do it, but just. So, SU3 structure. What is SU3 structure? So, or what are the G structures in general? So, the structure group of a manifold is a group of transformations required to patch the orthonormal frame bundle. When the manifold is Riemannian, the structure group is automatically SOD. But when we talk about reduced structure and supersymmetry, enforces the structure to be reduced, then the structure group won't be SOD, but will be a subgroup of SOD. And the biggest subgroup that we are going to allow is SU3. If the structure group is bigger than SU3, then there's no longer supersymmetry, it's no longer preserved. A manifold has chief structure, if equivalent, if any of these things happens, the structure group reduces to chief. Or there are globally defined non-vanishing chi invariant tensors, which in the case of SU3, these are the J2 and omega 3. Or there is a globally defined non-vanishing chi invariant spinor. So these definitions are equivalent. And again, this is the one, a globally defined non-vanishing chi invariant spinor is the one that is useful for supergravity. The group chi that we're interested in is SU3. So let's look at SU3 structure in six dimensions. So again, if we have SU3 structure, we can do the same decomposition of SO6 into SU3. So again, we are allowed to define, there's again an almost complex structure that allows to define complex coordinates. Maybe now this is not this is not globally well defined, so the transition functions between one patch and the other are not holomorphic, but we are still allowed to define local complex coordinates, so we are still allowed to do this decomposition. This is exactly the same decomposition as SU3 holonomy. So again, you see that there is a singlet here in the spinor, so this is the G invariant, the SU3 invariant spinor. There's a singlet here of the two forms, there's a singlet here in the two forms, and this two form is again obtained exactly in the same way as SU3 holonomy, as bilinears of the spinor. There's a singlet here, and it's obtained exactly in the same way. Now, what's different between SU3 structure and SU3 holonomy is that the spinor is no longer covariantly constant. So if you insert this into here, what you get is that J and omega are not closed. So you have SU3 invariant two form and three form, but these are not closed in general. They're only closed, they're both closed if you have SU3 holonomy. So here I'm talking about covariantly constant in the Levi-Civita connection. So they are covariantly constant in some, this is covariantly constant in some torsion connection. Now I will talk about this. So this connection here is the Levi-Civita.
So let me
tell you something for later use. We define the SU3 structure in terms of the invariant spinor or with the equivalent in terms of J and omega. But actually one can define the SU3 structure in terms of just real forms. So J is a real form, but omega is a complex form. But the SU3 structure can be defined in terms of just the real forms, which are J and rho. So, and rho is the real part of omega. These forms must be stable. This means that they live in an open orbit under the action of general linear transformation. An open orbit means that each element in the neighborhood of rho or J, they're both stable, is GL6R equivalent to rho. So there's a GL6R transformation that takes us from rho to a neighboring element of rho. So this means that these elements live in an open orbit. And this is the same as saying that they are stable. If we look at rho, this is a stable form. So the dimension of the orbit, then is the dimension, is equal to the dimension of lambda 3 of P star, so the dimension of three forms, which is 20. Because it lives in an open orbit. So the orbit has, the dimension of the orbit is 20. And the stabilizer, so the elements in GL6R, that such that rho is invariant, this is the stabilizer. The dimension of the stabilizer is then the dimension of GL6R minus the dimension of the orbit. The dimension of GL6R is 36, the dimension of the orbit we said is 20, so the dimension of the stabilizer is 21, sorry, it's 15, 21 was for the, 21 is for shape, so the dimension of the stabilizer is 15, 15, no, 16, 16, sorry. Yeah, they're very nice. And 16 is the dimension, I won't be right now. 16 is the dimension of SL3C. So the stable rod, so this is stable under the stabilizer is isomorphic to SL3C, so a stable rod defines an SL3C structure. And the same can be done with Shay, where now we do get the 21. So we say if you do this, you get the 21. And this is the dimension of the group symplectic 6R. So the stable shape defines a symplectic 6R structure. So together, they define an SU3 structure if there is some condition between rho and shape, which is this. Shape which rho is equal to 0, and shape u is equal to rho which rho hat, where rho hat is the imaginary, rho hat is imaginary part of omega, not of rho. And this is the dual, this is the star of rho. So this will, we will say much more about this in the third lecture. But since we're talking about the SU3 structure, I wanted to tell you this. And this means, this implies that the embedding of the symplectic group and SL3C are compatible. So we have this SL3C structure and symplectic 6R structure, and they both define an SU3 structure if their embeddings are compatible, and this enforces this condition.
Sorry, what's rho hat?
So rho hat, I will say more, rho hat is imaginary part of omega. So this is wrong, imaginary part of omega. So omega is rho plus I rho hat. And we will see, well, it can be seen that this is the six-dimensional star of rho. So sorry, there is this mistake and this mistake here. And now since SU3 is including SO6, Shay and rho also define an SO6 structure, and though they define, also they define the method. This implies that they define the method. So this is an aside now, but it will be important later. So back to torsion, what is the intrinsic torsion? Well, this I guess you know, but given a metric compatible connection, delta prime, so metric compatible means this, we can define the curvature and the torsion of this connection, and they are defined in the following way, by the commutator of two covariant derivatives, this is the curvature and the torsion. So this T here is the torsion. And Levi-Civita is a unique torsionless connection. Any delta prime, I go away a bit fast here, I guess. Any connection with torsion can be written as the Levi-Civita connection plus some k. This k is called contorsion. And metric compatibility implies that it's antisymmetric in the last two indices. KMNP is equal to minus KMPN. Now, if we insert this here, what we get is a one-to-one correspondence between this contortion and this torsion. And actually, so the torsion is the antisymmetry expression in the first two indices of the contortion, or the contortion can be found from the torsion in this way. If we look at the structure of the indices in the torsion, there, so this, it has two antisymmetric indices here. So these two antisymmetric, so these are M and N. This is isomorphic to the, this is a space of two forms. This M and N take indices, this is like a two form. And this is isomorphic to the Lie algebra SOD. And this SOD we decompose into the Lie algebra of the group G. And G perpendicular, so G is the structure group of the manifold. And this is a one index, so this is in lambda one. So this this takes in, this is in lambda 1 tensor G plus G perpendicular. So we said on the manifold with G factor, given a G invariant tensor, the covariant derivative of this tensor is in general not zero, but there is a torsion-full connection such that this connection with torsion, such that the covariant derivative in this connection with torsion of this G invariant tensor is equal to zero. This connection with torsion, we write it as the connection plus the contortion. And this contortion, there's a one-to-one correspondence between contortion and torsion, so what we do is we split this contortion into a part that is in lambda 1 tensor G perpendicular, so this tensor this, and another part which is in lambda 1 tensor G. Why is this useful? Because this is a G invariant tensor, so this term goes away. So this is G invariant, and then we're left with this piece. And this piece here is called intrinsic torsion. Like actually, this is the torsion associated to this contortion is intrinsic torsion.
Do you get the same connection with torsion for any G-invariant tensor? So if I
choose
a
G-invariant tensor can be covariantly constant in different connection with torsion. So this tells that there is a connection with torsion, and such that this is equal to zero. But then, in principle, it doesn't tell you what the torsion is.
So this Skinner is compatible with more than one piece structure of it.
Given a spinner, then it's going to be compatible. It can be compatible with more than one shift structure, but in general, it's compatible with one. But it could be compatible with more than one shift structure.
This G is Lyon
G. Yes.
Is
the orthogonal. So you decompose the group. You decompose SOV into G and then G orthogonal, and you decompose it in the algebra. Sorry?
With respect to the standard SOV invariant inner product?
You mean this decomposition?
Yeah, it's
orthogonal. Well, and then we will drop this zero from now on. We will talk about the intrinsic torsion. So the intrinsic torsion is the measure of the failure of a G structure to become G holonomy. And now what we will do is apply this connection with torsion on psi. Write it like this, so this is the intrinsic torsion. And then for psi we'll shape an omega, and then we want to anti-symmetrize to find the exterior derivative of omega and J. And this gives this this index structure. And what is useful is to decompose these four index tensors into this four form into representations of SU3, and the same with these three forms. So we want to decompose this. First we want to decompose T into representations of SU3, and these are the torsion classes. The decomposition of T into irreducible SU3 representations are the torsion classes. So again, this is in lambda 1 tensor SU3 orthogonal. This lambda 1 is in 3 plus 3 bar SU3 orthogonal. So SOV was the algebra of SOV was 1 plus 8 plus 3 plus 3 bar. The 8 goes away because it's the algebra of SU3, so we get this. Doing this product, this is what we get, and these are the torsion classes for SU3. So these torsion classes are called W1, W2, W3, W4, and W5.
So the part that's written there is just the intrinsic torsion part?
Yes, this is just the intrinsic torsion, yes. So W1 is a scalar. W2 in the 8 plus 8 is a 1-1 form, which is primitive, so the contraction with J is equal to 0. W3, which is the piece in the 6 plus 6 bar, is a 2-1 plus 1-2 primitive form. Also, the contraction with J is equal to 0. And W4 and W5 are 1, 0 plus 0, 1, so they are vectors. They are 1, 0 plus 0, 1 forms. These are the torsion classes. So now what we do is decompose this 4 form and this 3 form into these torsion classes and then shape an omega again. So we get this, that d shape and d omega, so are not 0 and are proportional to this. So d shape is proportional to the imaginary part of W1 omega, W3 and W4, and here we have W1, W2 and W5. So the manifolds that we know are complex manifolds, are such that W1 and W2 are non-zero. So this is equivalent to having a Ninus equal to 0 or having integrability of the complex structure. In terms of SU3, this means that W1 and W2 are equal to 0. So d omega is equal to W5 omega. Simplectic manifolds are such that dj is equal to 0. So W1, 3, and 4 are equal to 0 in simplectic manifolds. Kellier manifolds are both complex and simplectic. So 1, 2, 3, and 4 are equal to 0. The only left is W5. And when the next is Calabi-Yau manifolds, where they are all equal to 0. No torsions, so W1, 2, 3, 4, 5 are equal to 0. The case of conformal Calabi-Yau that I said a little bit at the beginning is when we do a rescaling. We take a Calabi-Yau manifold and we do a rescaling of the metric. If you do a rescaling of the metric, all gamma matrices get rescaled. And so J and omega get rescaled by factors. So W4 and W5 are non-zero, but they are related in this way. This is because omega has 3 gamma matrices, where J has 2 gamma matrices, so they should obey this condition. So this is conformal Calabi-Yau. And these are the manifolds that will appear in compactifications of type 2 supergravity. So in the same way that we decompose torsion in SU3 representations, we can decompose fluxes in SU3 representations. So again, we have the 1 plus 1, the 3 plus 3 bar, 6 plus 6 bar, and 8 plus 8. So this is all the decomposition of the NS and S3 form flux, the Ramonaum fluxes into A, and the Ramonaum fluxes into B. So you don't need to look at all these tables, but the things that we should notice from this table is that there are 2 zeros here. This means that there is no 8 plus 8 representation in H3, because 8 plus 8 also appears when there are even fluxes. And there is no 8 plus 8 representations in the Ramonaum fluxes in 2B because they are odd. So there is no 8 plus 8 representation of the fluxes in 2B. That means that no flux can create a W2 torsion. So in 2B, W2 is always equal to 0. There is no flux to compensate for this torsion. And W2 is a measure, is an obstruction to have integrability of the complex structure. So W2 is here. Is the one that needs to be 0 in complex manifolds. So the obstruction to have integrability of the complex structure, one of the obstructions to have integrability of the complex structure, we can see that it's automatically 0 in 2B. But on this, we can see just from decomposing into representations. In 2A, there's a 0 here, which means that there is no Ramonaum flux in the 6 plus 6 bar representation, because to have 6 plus 6 bar we need another form, but we do have a 6 plus 6 bar in 2A in the NSNS flux. So in 2A, if there is a W3, it has to be compensated by H. It cannot be compensated by Ramonaum fluxes. So if W3 is non-zero, it has to be related by H, and in particular the 6 plus 6 bar representation of H. And W3 is here, is in the non-closure of BJ. So this is an obstruction to have symplectic geometry, because symplectic geometry was BJ equal to 0. So we see that here W2 is equal to 0, and here W3 is ready to H in the 6. If also W1 is equal to 0, which is true in all supersymmetric vacuum with SU3 structure, this you cannot see from the table because here there are in principle enough scalars to compensate for W1, but you have to solve for supersymmetric equations and see that this happens. So maybe I'll say a few words later about this. So W1 is indeed equal to 0 in all supersymmetric bubbles with symmetric structure. Then in 2B, we get that W2 is equal to 0, W1 is equal to 0. So we get that d omega is equal to W5 omega. So the manifold is complex in 2B, the six-dimensional manifold. In 2A, we say W3 is related to H in the 6. Actually, the relation is not exactly this. We will see more precisely what it is. But in this shape, we have H in the 6, and then we have the W4. So we refer to this as the manifold is twisted symplectic. So it's symplectic up to, if this W4 is exact, which will be the case, it can be compensated by a redefinition of shape. We will see this precisely. And then this H acts as a twisting. I will be much more precise on this. So we see that in 2B, complex geometry arises, while in 2A, symplectic geometry arises. So from supergravity, we ask if there is a mathematical construction that contains complex and symplectic geometry, and maybe extends complex and symplectic geometry. And well, of course, you know what the answer to this is. This generalized complex geometry. So that's why generalized complex geometry appears from supergravity, and it's very important to understand supergravity vacuum, because generalized complex geometry contains complex and symplectic geometry. So it contains 2A and 2B vacuum in a single formulation. And so it's very nice to describe these flux backgrounds. Any questions? I will. I will be very precise in it. So symplectic will be this shape is equal to zero, right? We will see that W4 is always exact. So if it's exact, if it's D of something, then you can redefine shape to have this. If W4 is D5, for example, you can redefine shape to have an E to the 5, and then you create this. And then this H in the 6, this H will act as a twisting, and I will say tomorrow a lot about this twisting. So this W4 is not a problem, but this H is the part that appears as twisting. So the assumption that I'm doing is this, which is true, W1 is equal to 0 in supersymmetric vacuum, that this is exact, we will see that that's the case, and then that H acts as a twisting. So the manifold is twisted, symplectic, and twisted by H. But I will talk about this twisting.
Why
is W1 to 0? Because if W1 is not 0, then the manifold is not complex, for example. To be complex, you need W1 and W2 equal to 0. And here, that W2 is equal to 0, you can see just from the table. But W1, in principle, no, because it could be created by fluxes. You have fluxes in singular representations. But for this, you need to work out supersymmetric transformations and supersymmetric vacuum, and you find that W1 is equal to 0, and then you have this. Otherwise, W1 appears both here and here. So we couldn't say that here the manifold is complex and here the manifold is twisted symplectic.
And then in the supergravity
background, corresponds with
scalar have no
graph. Sorry?
The
corresponds with
scalar
to graph, the more
scalar.
In supergravity background, so you mean W1, for example? Yeah, so W1, in principle, you could have that W1 is equal to H, the singlet in H3. That would be a possible supergravity background, but this doesn't appear. It's actually non. I'm not sure even if it's not supersymmetric. It's probably not the solution to the equations of motion. This is true. Corresponding to the equation of motion corresponding to the metric, for example. Here we don't solve the equation of motion, we solve supersymmetry equations, which are first order. if you look at supersymmetry transformation of the gravitino, then I will talk about this more tomorrow. If you look at supersymmetry transformation of the gravitino, then you have W1 appearing, and you have the fluxes in the one appearing, but they cannot cancel each other. And then what you have is that W1 has to be equal to zero, and H in the one has to be equal to zero. So maybe tomorrow, tomorrow I'll show you how the supersymmetry transformation look like, and maybe you understand it better. Than. Any other?
So I want to understand the meaning of this table.
Yes.
W1, etc. are differential forms.
W1, W2 are the distortions, so are the
scalar terms of the
normal.
Yes, yes. And the fluxes are again differential forms. When you erase table, you would say that the W's are written in terms of the fluxes.
Yeah, well, yes, probably that's. Yes. This question. So supersymmetry equations are look like this. Delta psi, this is the one that we will look at. Plus H with some gamma matrices, and then plus F with some gamma matrices. Right? If you want the supersymmetry factor, you have to set this to zero. Now this here is proportional, I will tell you more later, but here what you get is, for example, W1, which is a scalar, what has appeared is W1 GMN gamma n epsilon plus W2, again W2 MN gamma n epsilon plus, etc. So from here, the covariant derivative of the spin, well, first, you split this into four-dimensional and six-dimensional spinor. Now, in the part of the six-dimensional spinor, this is not zero, but it's proportional to distortions. So you have distortion on this hand, you have the fluxes, which you also split into representation. And if you want this to be zero, what will happen is that an eighth representation cannot cancel a torsion in an eighth representation. What happens is cancellation, representation by representation. So this has to be cancelled with, for example, here you have also H in the 1, which is H in the 1 is H MNP omega MNP. H in the 1 appears in the same form as W1, so you have, if you look at all this, what you have is W1 plus I H in the 1, and then GMN gamma and epsilon, something like this. So if you want supersymmetry, then this has to be equal to zero. So W1 is cancelled by H in the 1. So in principle that would happen, but supersymmetry doesn't allow for this. It does allow though for example, you have W2 plus F, let's say F2, maybe 8 plus 8. And then gamma and epsilon, you have something like this, and here you can, this can be set to zero by setting F2, by setting W2 equal to F2, or W2, and this is a real form, so W2 plus, for example, one of the eights equal to F2.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I noticed that this form degree doesn't match, but can be tuned by using contracting.
Ah, yes. Yeah, so in the 1 means this, then in the 3, H in the 3, for example, is H, MNP, J, NP. There's always contraction, so to get these different representations, you either contract with omega or contract with J. Well, I guess then we'll start with more generalized complex geometry tomorrow. Right, unless we're, I don't know, I can.
What
I would say this is a natural breakpoint.
So do we have any more questions? If not, I'll remind you that Marianna's talking again tomorrow at the same time in the same place for part two of the lecture series. And we've got a lecture at 2:00 downstairs, down one floor. So let's
there's direct conversation on page one.
Yes.
How
That's a problem. If you want to compactify, that's a problem. So